Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects, the Fidelity Investments Canada podcast, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. In today's episode, we welcome back Fidelity Fixed Income Portfolio Manager Jeff Moore. Jeff brings his unique perspectives on global fixed income markets using a multi-sector lens. Jeff notes the optimistic tone around growth coming from the U.S. Federal Reserve, centered around the fast growth coming out of 2020 and adding on massive stimulus with the potential for more stimulus in the next month or two. Jeff and host Pamela Ritchie also discuss if the COVID variants have the potential to disrupt the markets, how the recent stimulus could affect currency, and Jeff's thoughts on bond-like alternatives. This podcast was recorded on the morning of March 17th, a few hours before Fed Chair Jerome Powell held his Federal Open Market Committee press conference. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
Joining us to share his perspective on what your bond playbook should look like over the longer term and what his looks like over the longer term, we're joined by portfolio manager Jeff Moore. Jeff runs a range of fixed income strategies for Canadian investors, including the Multi-Asset Innovation Fund and the Multi-Sector Bond Fund. Jeff Moore, how are you today?
Hi, Pamela. How are you?
Very well. Thank you. Jeff, let's just go sort of straight to what we've been watching. Everyone has been engaged in this story in some way. I guess, first off, how do markets test the Fed's resolve? I mean, does the market win? Does the Fed win? How do you see this in what Chair Powell will say this afternoon?
Yeah, so here's what I think happens today. I think Chair Powell comes out with basically a fairly dovish statement saying they have no in the near term to raise rates and foreseeable future. He might even act at the market. But I don't think he's going to do a lot more than that because, Pamela, he's going to have to acknowledge that we are in a reflation part of the cycle. And he's going to have to acknowledge that, you know, we had easy comps with COVID last year. Now it gets a lot. And so now we have really fast growth. And then when you add on $1.9 trillion in stimulus and then potential for another $4 trillion in stimulus in just the next month or two, I think he's going to be found a pretty optimistic tone around growth. So this is going to be his challenge. And so in that world, does the yield curve steepen even more? It could. Here's the problem that we have in the market right now as market participants. The yield curve right now is at the 70th percentile, which is to say we're already a really steep yield curve. Now, we can go steeper. We've been steeper before. Historically, though, we only get steeper when we think the Fed's really going to cut rates, not raise them, and or the Fed is actually confirming our bias. So here's our problem in the market. Even if we want to go steeper, which we can, because that's what, you know, the probabilities say it's possible. It's not probable, but possible. We're on our own as the marketplace without the Fed confirming it, which means that any kind of data, whether it's today or tomorrow or in 3 months, that suggests that this recovery is not as fast will actually be something the market has to move really quickly to unwind.
So in that, I mean, how then, so we'll get the comments this afternoon. I mean, we've seen what's going on in the equity markets. I've actually seen the equity markets sort of come back a little bit, but there's a lot of money out there that is concerned about how the velocity of rate rises might be. What sort of happens with the comments that you just made being likely? How do various markets react to that? Asset classes react to that?
Well, let's look at the really short end of the yield curve. Any market type in, they won't react at all. In fact, one of the issues right now in the short end of yield curves is there's way too many excess reserves in the system. Think of that being unlent deposits. And so if you're buying some kind of floating rate note right now, you're probably being priced at 1 or 2 basis points a year. And so the front end is not going to react at all. So all the action, if you're worried, has to be in the long end of the curve. And again, now the problem you have if you're the long end of the curve is you're on your own. The Fed's saying, we're kind of comfortable here, and we're going to look through this. And people should take into account here that Chair Powell is not alone. In fact, he's got a major ally in Secretary Yellen, and they see eye to eye. So if you think that the Fed's going to break and so forth, I wouldn't go there. If they need any spine stiffening, so to speak, they got Chair or Secretary Yellen there to help them. So on market probably results in sort of some momentum trades, but doesn't go anywhere big time just because it's hard to go a lot more. We could continue the momentum trade of steeper, but without a lot of energy. And then when I look at risk assets, risk markets are buying, in part because the risk assets are saying, hey, we can roll over all our debt pretty easily. The Fed is still very committed to easy financial conditions, which is a huge boon to the low investment grade debt and then even investment grade debt.
At this stage in the cycle, and I'm curious what you think, where we are in the cycle here, in sort of the fixed income cycle, how difficult will it be, and we're going to performance here, to beat various benchmarks? So this goes directly, obviously, to sort of the active versus passive, but it's an interesting point. If bonds are getting a little bit less attention right now because of all the issues we're talking about, how easy or hard is it to beat benchmarks?
So I don't think it's any easier or harder than it's ever been. And what I feel great about is, you know, over a long period of time, our team's proven we can beat benchmarks, not only long period, on a 1 year, 3 year, 5 year, 10 year. And I have no doubt we're going to do that in the future. That seems like just how our process is designed. But I don't think that the market's harder to beat now. In fact, I can make an argument that it's a little bit easier to beat because we have a low volatility environment. We have a lot of known knowns, and with the stimulus coming along, if you have some carry advantage, you're going to beat your benchmark. And the other part of this panel is you should know I'm not that bearish in the bond market. I think that maybe there's some people who are very bearish about inflation prospects and runaway this and that. I'm not there. I'm actually much more in a benign scenario that the bond market's in a low return phase. That's for sure. We've talked about that since November. But that's all I can say. I don't really want to say more than that because I don't think it's in a negative return phase. But again, there's not much in the way of big positive returns either.
Some people are comparing to what we're seeing now or maybe might see is sort of a mini taper tantrum that we saw when so-called the punch bowl was taken away after the great financial crisis. Are there similarities? I mean, much has been made of the fact that probably the central bank will make sure they don't do the same thing as last time. What do you see?
Yeah, I think you've hit it. I feel like this feels like it's a 2013 taper tantrum. And in fact, if you know, for a lot of clients that they've heard from me lately, they know we've been stress testing on 2013 taper tantrum, but for today. Now, the taper tantrum then was a little bit different. The Fed was giving us all the indications it was walking away. This Fed's not doing that at all. In fact, this Fed's going to say just the opposite 2013. So I think in the marketplace, we've got I'm going to call it a mini taper tantrum, and we're just steepening the curve. Probably that's as much part of the whole reflation narrative. We're coming out of COVID, comps are getting easier, and there's fiscal stimulus. I'm not necessarily certain that we get a full-on 2013 taper tantrum without the Fed confirming it. And so I'm actually kind of, like I said, getting to the point where I think the steepness of the curve is now actually we're heading into the tails of the steepness of the curve, which is to say it gets harder and harder for the curve to steepen in any meaningful way. And we'll have to watch for that. But 2013 would definitely be what I'm sort of stress testing on. And our quant, Stacey Ware, this is what she's thinking about a lot. But we're more in the camp of a mini taper tantrum.
Interesting. So the reflation, the reopening, lots of different words for it. You've mentioned inflation. The narrative is really what we're talking nonstop about. Everyone thinks that we will be in this. You mentioned that there aren't too many unknowns. Does reopening just sort of, obviously with normal hiccups, but does it just kind of roll along here? I mean, is there anything that you see interrupting that vis-a-vis sort of actions at the monetary level?
So, when it comes to reopening, our view is on a net basis, every day, sort of in the next 3 or 4 months, we're going to kind of reopen a little bit more. Now, that doesn't mean some part of the country won't have a little bit more tightness or a lockdown or something, but on a net, sort of the big sort of picture, you know, every day we reopen a little bit. So we feel like the market's kind of in the right space, that there is a reflation narrative. What's hard, right, is markets look forward, and I think markets have done a good job of pricing in reflation. And they've done a decent job of pricing in the fiscal stimulus that we have, the blue wave that we talked about with clients back in November. So the question I have, and what kind of gives us a little bit of pause, and where our stress testing says, you know, if we don't get confirmation that this steep yield curve is reasonable, the curve will have to head back to something like a more median slope, which would be a rally in rates, not a sell-off.
When you see things like the inflation numbers come through, I mean, they actually have not been crazy. Where do you see inflation? I mean, some will say that, in fact, we've only just gotten off the deflationary area and are only just moving into. But I mean, we're not seeing massive pieces of data in sort of the core CPI discussion. We're seeing other pieces of scarcity and snapback trade. But does inflation itself, do you see it this second right now?
So inflation top, the CPI numbers we've got recently haven't actually been that great in terms of what you would expect as part of this reflation narrative, which, you know, on one hand, that's really great because it allows the Fed to stay lower for longer. On the other hand, it kind of makes you a little nervous. If we can't get the price level on a year-over-year basis to be much higher now, what happens when the comps get tougher in 6 months? And so if you ask me for a path, it's not that inflation goes from 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 to 6. That path, I guess, possible, but probably not happening. What could be the path, and I think this would be the path that would, you know, investors should think about as an alternative, is we get inflation 3%-ish plus minus, and then by December of this year, we're back into the ones again.
Right. Interesting. So it's interesting. It's like a snapback and then a rollback of some sort. So that's sort of something that you say you're thinking about. Okay. So let's bring in some of the different areas, obviously, where you're putting investment dollars to work. Lots of discussion about asset classes. And you talked about risk. How much will rising yields, maybe up to that point that you mentioned, impact high yield bonds? How are you positioning the funds? So into some of the nitty gritty of how you make this environment work.
Yeah. So right now we're positioning the portfolios. We still have what I would consider an average amount of tracking error. Now, average is tough because it's through a cycle and there's lots of tails to that. So we think default risk is going to stay low. And why? Because there's wide open financial markets, financial conditions are easy. And most companies that needed to roll over bonds have done so. The hard part with high yield now is it's trading at its call, which is to say it's going to be hard to get capital gains, right? So keep that in mind, that we're okay with risk assets, but we think the upside again gets back to limited. It's there, you can get the yield, but you can't get much more than that. And so we've actually taken down a lot of the risk, but we still have a nice overweight to risk, if that makes sense. And we're just picking and choosing our spots. We've taken most of our risk and shortened its tenor, in maturity tenor, getting closer to maturity. And where we're actually looking to take more risk down the road is if and when the yield curve does steepen, if it does steepen more, we're going to be more excited about buying actually government bonds again.
Great. Yeah, that's so interesting. That's what I wanted to ask next. Okay, so there's some thoughts on which countries are managing things better right now. How does that play into a sovereign investment?
Well, there's some countries are looking like they're reflating fast. The United States, certainly with this massive stimulus in the U.S., not only from last year, but the $1.9 trillion. And we're in the wings is a multi-trillion dollar, you know, capital spending slash a little bit of tax increases program. So the U.S. looks like it's going to snap out of this a little faster. Europe, not so much. In fact, the ECB, with the recent backup in rates, the ECB was pretty aggressive with markets, saying we're going to increase our repurchases. We don't actually think higher yields make sense for a lot of the countries in the Eurozone. And so we think that you're going to have this two-tiered interest rate environment where a lot of the world, think of Japan and Europe, will have extraordinarily low yields, and maybe the U.S. and maybe Canada down the road will have a little bit higher yields, but still lower yields than we're all used to.
That's fascinating, watching some of those subtleties come to light, and you know, and frankly, just where the sort of virus management comes into this story, along with stimulus. There's been some discussions. Denise Chisholm told him a little while, and I know you've said this too, that just because tons of stimulus are dropped into a country fighting whatever it is does not necessarily mean that you know, that the currency, it actually is often good for the currency. So I'll go there next. I mean, we have seen some dollar strength. I guess the question is still sort of this transitory strength or not, but you must watch that. What do you think about that? What does it indicate for you?
Yeah, so when we think about currency, remember currencies, the Canada US currency, for instance, is one of the most, is a very volatile thing to bet on. So you have to be very mindful that when you have a view on the Canadian currency, that it could go against you, and it can go against you like with the same kind of value as a stock. So keep that in mind. It's much riskier than debt. So think about Canada-US FX. The Canadian dollar has done extraordinarily well through this whole period. Now, in part, my analyst will tell you it's because we're in a massive range. The Canada-US dollar range is like 15 cents. And it just winds around relative, but because the countries are so close in so many different ways, it's hard to break out of this range. And so we've had the Canadian dollar surge recently. We still think that some of the other currencies around the world make sense versus the US dollar. Although, you know, if the US dollar is going to have the fastest recovery and it's going to have the highest interest rates, then interest rate parity would suggest that the US dollar wants to gain versus others that are flat on their back, right? So this is where our head is at. So we still like the US dollar here. We think it's still the right base currency for us. But for our Canadian investors, we'd really like you to have a hedged version of this program, just because you've had a 10 cent plus move in the Canadian dollar in the last like 8 months. And in a lot of ways, it doesn't really mean anything. That's the hard part. It's not really telling you a ton about the relative competitiveness of the US versus Canada, other than you're wearing a massive range trade.
So back to bond benchmarks. They are negative so far for the year. Do you expect they'll recover before the end of this year? There's probably a lot in that question that still needs to unfold. What do you think?
Yeah, so when we stress test, you know, things like multi-sector, one of the products we've talked about today, or that we run, when we stress test it for a standard deviation move in almost any prices against us. And we like to actually have enough yield to offset a one standard deviation move, whether it's in the stock market, whether it's in interest rates, whether it's in credit spreads. And that's how the portfolio has been designed. We spend a lot of time trying to say, hey, we know we're going to be wrong to a greater or lesser degree on our macro call and on our sector call. What we try to do is have a portfolio that is stress tested. And because of those stress tests, it can offset a big price move against you. And that's still where we are. We have a lot more yield than we had just a few months ago, and we're excited about that. And the negative price action so far hasn't actually been outside of anything that we've been expecting.
Jeff, another question about so-called bond vigilantes. I mean, we're seeing sort of market driven trying to push the Fed into, I guess, a decision. How do you want to describe bond vigilantes, and whether that's an old term or it's an appropriate term, and how much more of it do you see, if at all?
I don't really think we have bond vigilantes. And I'll tell you this, you know, if you go back to March 2020, the markets all fell apart, and you can give the Federal Reserve, you know, the gold star for coming in, getting control of the U.S. yield curve, and then helping settle down risk markets. And so the idea that the marketplace itself is going to try to unsettle the Fed, that just doesn't wash with me.
Maybe it's very French Revolution sounding. It's an interesting it's been used, and it's, you know, it's popular, but it maybe, I was curious what you thought. Do you know of specific sectors within high yield that could see capital gains? So kind of focusing back on the high yield space.
Oh boy, high yield tough for capital gains. For yields, I like the yield there. But even let's look at distressed debt and high yield. It's sub 10%.
Right.
And if you talk to Harley Lang, who's a great colleague and portfolio manager who runs our high yield for me, Harley would tell me that, to get capital gains out of distressed, you really want to be starting with mid double digit returns, yields. And we're not there right now. So it's hard to get capital gains.
Do you really see no move out of the Fed until 2023?
So, the bond market's pricing in 25 and 22 and 25 and 23. And so I think those are both reasonable outcomes. Like, I don't disagree with the market's perspective per se. What I really wanted to see is, what do we look like the second half of this year once all the fiscal stimulus is behind us and in price? What does the market look out and say, okay, now what? And I'm just more cautious, I guess maybe I'm the bond manager, I'm just more cautious that we may not see as a robust recovery, durable recovery, as people might think. And so what I would suggest is just be aware that the market's priced it in and they can price it out pretty quick too.
Are you concerned about virus variants interrupting the market in all seriousness? I mean, there are lockdowns being discussed in Northern Italy. I mean, I'm not sure anyone looks at that and thinks, oh, no, you won't do that to me again. But in all seriousness, do you see that interrupting a recovery?
So if you ask me what's the thing that does concern me a little bit, is we've added a ton of debt as part of all of our recoveries. And for some countries, debt sustainability is going to be an issue. And I'll give you one example, Italy. Italy right now, the Italian bond yield is 70 basis points.
Right.
It's very likely that its deficits become unhinged if yields go above 1%.
Even Mario Draghi can't perhaps put that genie back in the bottle. There have been some questions rolling around about, other types of bond-like assets or things that will be protection. I kind of want you to throw that wide open to you and just get your thoughts on it. Other things that are being discussed going into the 40 side of a 60-40 portfolio, be they crypto, be they even gold. I mean, gold as well. What is your thought on some of those topics and assets?
Well, I've been at this for a long time and forever. The question is there more than two asset classes that diversify you? Are commodities a secular, something you should just have in your portfolio? And now the new thing is Bitcoin. Should that just be part of your portfolio, or gold? And what I would say to all that is, depends on who you are and all that good stuff. But think about this. When you replace me in your portfolio, me the bond manager, remember, I'm trying to be a low vol provider, 3-5% volatility. That's kind of our range. The stock market's 15 vol. If you look at Bitcoin, it's 40 vol. If you put oil in there, its implied volatility is 50%. So the problem you have is when you take me out, that's fine, but you probably replace me with something extraordinary, more volatility.
Very interesting point. That kind of shuts it down, actually, as a matter of fact. We may come back to it. There might be other questions, but that's pretty good answer. There is sort of this, I won't call it a sideshow, it's a very important side of what we're going to hear this afternoon, or the market hopes it might hear, but this supplemental leverage ratio, which essentially is what, big banks need to have in their books as tier one capital. There's discussions about where that might move. Can you bring us up to date and maybe what you're looking for on that front?
Yeah, so the SLR, as they say, this is basically an outcropping from 08. One of the lessons out of 08 is we recognized rightly that the banking systems, whether Canada, US, or the rest around the world, are heavily levered. By design, by the way. These are by design. And so most banking systems are levered 10 to 1, like 10% equity, another 90%-ish in loans and so forth. And so if you have a blow up in a loan portfolio, it can eat into equity quickly. So this whole SLR comes to life. But the other part of the SLR is because banks are such a part of the monetary money supply system, if you're the government, the Fed, who's a regulator, or even the Canadian government, where the superintendent of financial institutions is there in Ottawa, you can actually, by moving the SLR or supplemental ratios, affect monetary policy and loans that are in the system. And so if you think you're getting a little too inflationary, but you don't want to raise rates, one thing to consider is just to force the banks to have a little higher capital ratio so they can't lend as fast. Because remember, the money supply in Canada and US, M1A is cash in your pocket, right? This is first year university stuff. M2 is where the banking system comes in. The banking system is 100% of GDP. So in a lot of ways, the banking system is three times bigger than the central banks at this stage. And so if you do something on the supplementary ratios, which is designed to, you know, be safety and soundness of the system, it also has a knock-on effect on the monetary supply, the money supply, which is to say, for people who think inflation may be running really, really fast, it wouldn't take a lot of change to the SLR to slow down the supply of money to the system.
Interesting. And, you know, and that's the question that circulates when you see, you know, big airlines coming to the market in the last couple of weeks, sort of these questions surrounding, are they better to come now or are they doing it before they see rates go up? I mean, there are sort of these timing questions. Any final thoughts on sort of the timing of what we're in the midst of right now?
Yeah, so one of the things to consider and just keep really front and center as investors is we have an aging society, demographic trends, which are secular. We probably had a baby bust this year. The data is early, so we don't know, but keep an eye on that. And it means a global population growth is really slowed and maybe falling, we think, in at least six of the 10 countries. The reason I say this is one thing about a 50-year-old versus a 25-year-old. A 50-year-old is a more prodigious saver. And so real interest rates are likely to want to stay low just because we have a preponderance of 50-year-olds in our system, more than we've ever had, who had 20 years of saving. And this is the challenge, right? That real rates can stay low for an extended period of time because we just don't have enough borrowers.
That's interesting. We don't have enough borrowers. People don't want to borrow more. That has sort of an element within corporations as well. Can you speak more to whether you're adding duration and long-term government bonds? So you said that there might be something interesting in the offing there. Can you just expand a bit more?
Yeah. So I'm thinking that if you're like me and think Fed funds is stuck near zero, at least for the year, and that's kind of what the market's saying too. And then you look at the slope of the curve and we're standing on our edge right now. Okay. So we're at the 70th percentile. So we have two tens, it's 1.5%. So if you get to sort of 175, 180, now you're the 90th percentile for slope. If you add those two things together, you get a 10-year yield that's still sub 2%. If your call is that the 10-year yield goes to 2% by 2024, right, because of the way the rates are looking now, that's if you just owned a portfolio of 10-year treasuries, you still would have a small positive return, even though you know rates are going up because it's going up slow enough. And so this is our challenge as investors. Thinking about the 10-year treasury could actually be a buy at some point, maybe a temporary buy, but it could be a buy. But it's a buy based on the fact that even when the Fed decides to start raising rates, it'll be the pace of those rate hikes combined with real interest rates and demographics combined with our inflation expectations that take us to the point where you go, oh, okay, the 10-year is ultimately going to go to 3% in the US, let's say, pretend, but that's going to take 10 more years. And along the way, I'm still going to get a 2% coupon and I'll outperform other things.
Jeff Moore, thank you so much for joining us today. Very glad to have your voice contributing to all of these topics on Fed Day.
Thank you, Pamela.
Thanks for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice. And if you like what you're hearing, leave a review or a 5-star rating. You can visit fidelity.ca for more information on future live webcasts. And don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter. Thanks again. See you next time.